holding scientific research and discovery in respect as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention. Among the importance of economic instruments and free markets were included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. Welcome to Technocracy News. Patrick Wood here, editor-in-chief and founder of Technocracy News and Trends. You might remember back on May 24, 2019, that Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti launched the Green New Deal for the city of Los Angeles. The article that appeared on Technocracy News and Trends on that date says that Mayor Eric Garcetti today released Los Angeles's Green New Deal, which sets aggressive goals for the city's sustainable future, tackles the climate emergency with accelerated targets, strengthens our economy and our middle class, and sets LA on a course to be carbon neutral by 2050. And that is exactly what they're trying to do. That article continued, the Green New Deal leads with bold action to zero out Los Angeles's main sources of harmful emissions. Buildings, transportation, electricity, and trash. Our accelerated goals and new targets include building a zero-carbon electricity grid, reaching an accelerated goal of 80% renewable energy by the year 2036, as we lead California towards 100% renewables by 2045. So that set the stage for Los Angeles to become one of the first cities in the United States to go completely green and be part of the Green New Deal. New York was the first, and since then, Seattle, Washington has followed in its footsteps. But Los Angeles set very ambitious goals. Today, we find a headline like this. Los Angeles is going solar to fulfill Green New Deal pledge. And yes, this is one of the first major stories that's appeared since their original announcement on what they're actually going to do to put their Green New Deal into practice. I wrote at the top of this article, however, if history is a guide, Los Angeles' alternative energy program will be far from low cost and will end up with irate customers, higher rates, and energy outages that harm businesses as well. So this article announces that Los Angeles regulators on Tuesday of this week approved a, quote, historically low cost, close quote, solar plus storage project, which includes 400 megawatts of solar generation and a 300-megawatt/1,200-megawatt battery. The Los Angeles Department of Water and Power Board of Commission says its approval of the power purchase agreements for the Eland Solar and Storage Center will help the city reach 100% renewables by 2045. City officials said the Eland project was selected from a pool of 130 proposals due to its scale and price, which includes fixed cost of less than 0.02 or 2 cents per kilowatt hour. The project will be developed in two phases by 8-Minute Energy and is expected online by the end of 2023. According to the city, it will be the largest similar project in the United States. Los Angeles utility regulators have signed off on two PPAs they say will cost consumers less than $5 annually, a sign of how far solar prices have fallen. The Eland project is historically low cost. Evan Gillespie, Western Director for Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, said the statement. He continued, "This is what a Green New Deal looks like in practice," he added, pointing to added job creation and lower carbon emissions. The project will be the first utility-scale integrated solar and battery project, though the PPAs are subject to City Council approval. Los Angeles is making the investment jointly with Glendale Water and Power, which will receive 12.5% of the total solar and battery storage. The Elon project will be located 70 miles north of Los Angeles. Operations are expected to begin in 2022, with the full operational capabilities coming online in 2023. Well, the only thing I can say about Los Angeles is it's headed for trouble. It bought into a solar/battery program by picking the lowest bidder at a very unrealistic cost, and it's likely going to find out that the whole project will fall apart in the end, and guess what? Los Angeles will be left with the hubris and angry taxpayers to boot. So Los Angeles is moving down the trail towards a Green New Deal. We can watch it step by step. The second story today is titled 5G Seeks to Disrupt Everything, Including Your Life. My comments are, is 5G a solution looking for a problem, or a problem looking for a solution? Despite the overwhelming hype or urgency to implement, very few outside of global corporations are buying the hype. 5G's future is still very much in doubt. And I'll stand behind that statement because even as the leaders of the companies like Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile are saying we're marching ahead at full speed, it could be that their hype will not live up to the reality of the matter. They're facing resistance on all sorts of levels, as are other companies throughout the world that are implementing 5G. And it's not going to be as easy as they thought it would be. In order for 5G to be successful, it requires full implementation across society. This likely just is not going to happen in the short term. There will be pockets of 5G located in dense areas like larger cities, but just don't expect that it will be blanketing everything, including rural areas, anytime soon. Why does 5G matter? The article states, to answer that question, we have excerpted from a recent Deutsche Bank report explaining, quote, how 5G will change your life. Amidst hype and high expectation, the 5G rollout has begun. It recently launched in Korea, while the US, UK, and others have commenced trial versions, and China has said it will soon grant commercial licenses for its network. To take advantage, companies such as Samsung and LG have launched 5G smartphones. In total, $160 billion is being invested annually in the construction of 5G networks, according to the GSMA, the Mobile Network Operators Association. It expects 5G to contribute $2.2 trillion to the global economy in the coming 15 years, just a little less than the size of the UK economy. Yet, for all the fanfare, many in the industry are quite nervous. Among other things, one of the biggest concerns is that there is no, quote, killer application ready and waiting to be unleashed that requires the 5G network. That trepidation stands in direct contrast to the 4G and 3G rollouts. The former allowed good quality streaming video, and the latter, photo sharing and other types of multimedia. Both were a boon for hardware, software, and network providers. So, is this a situation of build it and they will come? Will the rollout of 5G spur a frenzied development of 5G-specific applications in a similar way to how 4G catalyzed a plethora of video-related products? Or will the network providers need to see evidence of demand for 5G and a willingness to pay before they can justify the expense of rolling out 5G beyond city centers? While we wait for the killer app to be developed, the answer is still probably a bit of both until a virtuous cycle is established. The thing that is unlike the move to 3G and 4G, some of the most important uses of the 5G network are unlikely to take place on a smartphone, at least for now. Instead, the initial uptake in 5G will likely be driven by the manufacturing industry and public utilities, not individual consumers. Some countries have made significant plans for this. Germany, for example, has reserved a 100 megahertz band between 3.7 and 3.8 gigahertz to be used exclusively by industrial companies for their local networks. German company Siemens is one of the companies at the forefront of 5G industrial application. Some call it the industrial Internet of Things, others Industry 4.0. Either way, the story is the same. The IIoT is a network of intelligent industrial devices, that is, machines that have inbuilt sensors that collect data and communicate with each other. This allows them to adjust how they perform a task to what is happening elsewhere in the factory, to inform a human of a certain need, to make the process more efficient. The idea is not new, but so far, smart factories have been extremely limited. This is an article that's worth reading and considering. In the past, all development of wireless technology has been driven by consumers, that is, those who demanded more capable smartphones and were willing to pay the price to get them. Speed was a big deal. So when 4G came out, a lot of people turned over their old 3G phones and upgraded so they could have the additional speed. But now that speed has become perfectly acceptable with 4G LTE, there's very little incentive for people with smartphones to move up to a 5G smartphone. Well, this source of income is not going to be available to support the 5G rollout. There will be some people, of course, that do upgrade to 5G. But for the most part, that income stream is going to be missing during the rollout of 5G. This means that the 5G companies are going to have to look elsewhere to collect revenue. This means they're going to have to sign up smart cities by the dozens. They're going to have to sign up smart factories and companies that can use this data and license and pay for it with big bucks. Will they be able to do this? Nobody really knows for sure. My guess is they're going to find out it's a lot harder to extract money out of cities and out of companies than it is out of individuals. Time will tell. Our last story, and unquestionably the most important story, I've titled, Know Your Constitution or Get Ready for No Constitution. This article is written by constitutional attorney John Whitehead, who is the founder and CEO of the Rutherford Institute. I wrote at the top of this, technocracy and its technocrat practitioners have always hated the U.S. Constitution and are doing everything in their power to effectively destroy it. When the turmoil reaches epic proportions, it will ultimately be suspended altogether. The article starts out with a quote from Margaret Atwood's famous book, The Handmaid's Tale. Quote, that was when they suspended the Constitution. They said it would be temporary. There wasn't even any rioting in the streets. People stayed home at night, watching television, looking for some direction. There wasn't even an enemy you could put your finger on. Close quote. It's been 230 years since James Madison drafted the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, as a means of protecting the people against government tyranny. And what do we have to show for it? Nothing good. In America today, the government does whatever it wants, freedom be damned. We can pretend that the Constitution, which was written to hold the government accountable, is still our governing document. But the reality of life in the American police state tells a different story. We, the people, have been terrorized, traumatized, and tricked into a semi-permanent state of compliance by a government that cares nothing for our lives or our liberties. The bogeyman's names and faces have changed over time. Terrorism, the war on drugs, illegal immigration, etc. But the end result always remains the same. In the so-called name of national security, the Constitution has been steadily chipped away at, undermined, eroded, whittled down, and generally discarded to such an extent that what we are left with today is but a shadow of the robust document adopted more than two centuries ago. Most of the damage has been inflicted upon the Bill of Rights. A recitation of the Bill of Rights, set against a backdrop of government surveillance, militarized police, SWAT team raids, asset forfeiture, eminent domain, overcriminalization, armed surveillance drones, whole body scanners, stop and frisk searches, all sanctioned by Congress, the White House, the courts, and the like, would understandably sound more like a eulogy to freedoms lost than an affirmation of rights we truly possess. And here's what it means to live under the Constitution today. The First Amendment is supposed to protect the freedom to speak your mind, assemble, and protest nonviolently without being bridled by the government. It also protects the freedom of the media, as well as the right to worship and pray without interference. In other words, Americans should not be silenced by the government. To the founders, all of America was a free speech zone. Despite clear protection found in the First Amendment, the freedoms described therein are under constant assault. Increasingly, Americans are being arrested and charged with bogus contempt of cop charges, such as disrupting the peace or resisting arrest, for daring to film police officers engaged in harassment or abusive practices. Journalists are being prosecuted for reporting on whistleblowers. States are passing legislation to muzzle reporting on cruel and abusive corporate practices. Religious ministries are being fined for attempting to feed and house the homeless. Protesters are being tear-gassed, beaten, arrested, and forced into free speech zones. And under the guise of government speech, the courts have reasoned that the government can discriminate freely against any First Amendment activity that takes place within a government forum. The Second Amendment was intended to guarantee the right of the people to keep and bear arms. Essentially, this amendment was intended to give the citizenry the means to resist tyrannical government. Yet, while gun ownership has been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court as an individual citizen right, Americans remain powerless to defend themselves against SWAT team raids and government agents armed to the teeth with military weapons better suited for the battlefield. As such, this amendment has been rendered null and void. The Third Amendment reinforces the principle that civilian elected officials are superior to the military by prohibiting the military from entering any citizen's home without the consent of the owner. With the police increasingly training like the military, acting like the military, and posing as military forces, complete with heavily armed SWAT teams, military weapons, assault vehicles, etc., it is clear that we now have what the founders feared most, a standing army on American soil. The Fourth Amendment prohibits government agents from conducting surveillance on you or touching you or invading you unless they have some evidence that you're up to something criminal. In other words, the Fourth Amendment ensures privacy and bodily integrity. Unfortunately, the Fourth Amendment has suffered the greatest damage in recent years and has been all but eviscerated by an unwarranted expansion of police powers that includes strip searches and even anal and vaginal searches of citizens, surveillance, corporate and otherwise, and intrusions justified in the name of fighting terrorism, as well as the outsourcing of otherwise illegal activities to private contractors. The Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment work in tandem. These amendments supposedly ensure that you are innocent until proven guilty, and government authorities cannot deprive you of your life, your liberty, or your property without the right to an attorney and a fair trial before a civilian judge. However, in the new suspect society in which we live, where surveillance is the norm, these fundamental principles have been upended. Certainly, if the government can arbitrarily freeze, seize, or lay claim to your property, that is money, land, possessions, under government asset forfeiture schemes, you have no true rights. The Seventh Amendment guarantees citizens the right to a jury trial. Yet, when the populace has no idea of what's in the Constitution, civic education has virtually disappeared from most school curriculums, that inevitably translates to an ignorant jury incapable of distinguishing justice and the law from their own preconceived notions and fears. However, as a growing number of citizens are coming to realize, the power of the jury to nullify the government's actions and thereby keep balance in the scales of justice is not to be underestimated. Jury nullification reminds the government that we, the people, retain the power to ultimately determine what laws are just. The Eighth Amendment is similar to the Sixth in that it is supposed to protect our rights of the accused and forbid the use of cruel and unusual punishment. However, the Supreme Court's determination that what constitutes cruel and unusual should be dependent on the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. This leaves us with little protection in the face of a society lacking in moral standards altogether. The Ninth Amendment provides that other rights not enumerated in the Constitution are nonetheless retained by the people. Popular sovereignty, the belief that the power to govern flows upward from the people rather than downward from the rulers, is clearly evident in this amendment. However, it has been since turned on its head by a centralized federal government that sees itself as supreme and which continues to pass more and more laws that restrict our freedoms under the pretext that it has an important governmental interest in doing so. As for the Tenth Amendment's reminder that the people and the states retain every authority that is not otherwise mentioned in the Constitution. That assurance of a system of government in which power is divided among local, state, and national entities has long been rendered moot by the centralized Washington, D.C. power elite, the president, Congress, and the courts. Indeed, the federal governmental bureaucracy has grown so large that it has made local and state legislatures relatively irrelevant. Through its many agencies and regulations, the federal government has stripped states of the right to regulate countless issues that were originally governed at the local level. If there is any sense to be made from this recitation of freedoms lost, it is simply this. Our individual freedoms have been eviscerated so that the government's powers could be expanded. Yet, those who gave us the Constitution and the Bill of Rights believed that the government exists at the behest of the citizens. It is there to protect, defend, and even enhance our freedoms, not violate them. It was no idle happenstance that the Constitution opens up with these three powerful words, "We the people," as the preamble proclaims, quote, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America." In other words, we have the power to make and break the government. We are the masters and they are the servants. We, the American people, the citizenry, are the arbiters and ultimate guardians of America's welfare, defense, liberty, laws, and posterity. Still, it's hard to be a good citizen if you don't know anything about your rights or how the government is supposed to operate. As the National Review rightly asks, quote, "How can Americans possibly make intelligent and informed political choices if they don't understand the fundamental structure of their government? American citizens have the right to self-government, but it seems that we increasingly lack the capacity for it." I highly recommend that you read this entire article. It's very thoughtful, and this is exactly what prompted me to strike the headline of "Know the Constitution or Get Ready for No Constitution." I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. See you next time.